Indians. He also suggested that they were more common in the mountainous regions of Italy. I have found by my inquiries that the Alps and the Apennines are frequently shaken. While his temporal predictions have not stood the test of time, his spatial patterns have proven fairly reliable. The Apennines have been one of the most frequent sites of Italian earthquakes. The seismic hazard map of Italy shows a region of highest risk down the spine of the boot. This is the result of the region's complex plate tectonic setting. On the grander scale, as we saw with Pompeii, the African plate is moving north into the Eurasian plate. But it is complicated by smaller pieces, called microplates, which jostle around the boundaries. The Adriatic plate is a microplate underlying the Adriatic Sea to the east of Italy, and it seems to be moving independently of both the African and Eurasian plates. Specifically, part of the Adriatic plate is subducting under Italy, thus forming the Apennine Mountains that run the vertical length of the country. More so than in many earthquake-prone regions, the earthquakes in the Apennines tend to come in clusters. We have seen how, in the earliest days of seismology, near the turn of the 20th century, Fusakichi Omori put forth an equation to describe how one earthquake triggers another. While the underlying principle is true for all earthquakes, the parameters of the equation vary between regions and between individual earthquakes. One magnitude 7, for instance, might trigger a small aftershock sequence with just one or two magnitude 5 aftershocks, like the 1989 Loma Prieta near San Francisco. Another might be followed by hundreds of magnitude 5s. It could be followed by a larger earthquake, like the magnitude 7.2 off the coast of northern Japan in 2011, that was followed 2 days later by a magnitude 9. While any individual occurrence is hard to anticipate, we do see regional tendencies in these variations. The Apennines are one of the regions where clusters of small earthquakes are common. That said, from time to time, those clusters will include a larger, damaging earthquake. The clusters can go on for days, weeks, or months before they get bigger or not. This type of cluster presents real problems for seismologists trying to talk about risk. A study done by the National Institute of Geophysics and Volcanology, INGV, in Rome, found that about 2% of these Italian swarms include a large earthquake. That means that if a cluster has begun, there is about a 2% chance of a damaging earthquake during its duration. Seen another way, there is a 98% chance that there will not be a damaging earthquake. Nonetheless, this still represents a significant increase in risk. Consider the difference. In a given location, a damaging earthquake happens only once in hundreds of years. A random month has, say, a 1 in 10,000 chance of seeing a major earthquake. The 1 in 50 chance, once a cluster is underway then, represents a 200-fold increase in risk. Still, it is only 1 in 50. 49 of those 50 clusters will produce nothing. So what should be said to the public? That the risk has gone up by 200 times? Or that there is a 98% chance that nothing will happen? Seismologists have a love-hate relationship with earthquake prediction. The drive to make patterns and predictions is baked into any scientist's DNA. And yet it has always fallen just tantalizingly out of our grasp. Seismologists began cataloging earthquakes in the earliest 20th century in the hope of discovering meaningful patterns. Harry Wood, one of the early giants in seismology, wrote a proposal in 1921 to install the first seismographs in Southern California, justifying it by saying that if we could see where the small earthquakes happened, this information might let us know where the big ones would be. This has turned out to be only partly true. Some small earthquakes occur near the major faults, but the San Andreas Fault stays quiet, breaking only in the largest earthquakes. And the small earthquakes have not turned out to have any clear information about the time of big earthquakes, outside the basic aftershock triggering pattern described by Omori in 1891. These hopes are weighed against the bad science and even fraud committed in the name of earthquake prediction. That's to say nothing of that constant stream of hopeless letters from would-be predictors. We have learned to be very skeptical of any such claims. After the first data was collected in the 1920s and 30s, and the lack of pattern became apparent, most scientists focused instead on understanding why earthquakes happen, at least until the Haichung earthquake, which, with its unlikely survivors, made it clear something had gone right. Formal government programs were reinitiated in the United States, Japan, and the Soviet Union in hopes of solving this riddle once and for all. The Haichung earthquake showed us some of the Chinese approaches to prediction. Most of the research there and elsewhere centered on the idea that in order for a major earthquake to happen, stress had to build up along a fault, and therefore we should look for evidence of that increasing stress. Strain meters, instruments that directly measure the deformation of the ground, were installed along faults. The Chinese investigated shifts in groundwater chemistry. It made a kind of physical sense. If rocks were highly stressed and started to crack, they could release gases into the water, changing its composition in a demonstrable way. The cracking could arguably also change the electrical conductivity of rocks in the vicinity. There was even a controlled experiment in California, in line with China's citizen science, to put to the test once and for all whether animals could perceive earthquakes before we do. Farmers along the central part of the San Andreas Fault, where magnitude 5 earthquakes are pretty common, were enrolled in a program to report their animals' behavior. They issued reports at least weekly and were not allowed to submit a report about the behavior of their animals before an earthquake after the earthquake took place to make sure that what they reported wasn't influenced by their knowledge that an earthquake had indeed occurred. But as the years went on, these investigations mostly came to naught. Strain meters registered changes, but analysis showed they were reflecting not seismic stress, but changes in groundwater levels, as California's boom and bust climate fluctuated between drought and flood. Water chemistry studies were equally disappointing. There had been hope that radon gas in groundwater might be a useful indicator. Radon is produced by radioactive decay, especially in granites, and it would be reasonable to infer that increased radon in the water was a result of ground cracking and thus seismic activity. But a careful study in Iceland convincingly demonstrated that there was no change in radon before volcanic eruptions, which put even more stress on rocks than earthquakes. And no, animals cannot predict earthquakes. Controlled studies showed no more reports of unusual behavior before earthquakes than at any other time. Smart young researchers concluded that their careers would be better served by investigating topics more likely to be successful. And so, after a couple of decades of focus, interest in prediction once again faded away. The nature of earthquakes is such that you can appear to be successful in finding patterns for quite a long time before you have to face the fundamental failure of your prediction. Earthquakes happen all the time, after all. It is remarkably easy to be right just by random chance. A magnitude 5 earthquake happens somewhere in the world every 8 hours. If you declare there will be a magnitude 5 earthquake tomorrow without specifying a location, odds are you'll be right. Some exploit this fact for fraud. I remember in 1994 hearing about a man who sent a fax to a company in Los Angeles predicting that a magnitude 6-plus earthquake would occur in the next week. When his prediction was borne out, with the Northridge earthquake that caused $40 billion in damage, the company was impressed. They were ready to listen to his proposal that they buy further earthquake predictions from him. What they didn't know was that he had sent the same fax to a different company each week, waiting for random chance to make him look successful. More insidious is our ability to fool ourselves. Imagine you're a scientist who's predicted a magnitude 5 for a particular region at a particular time. There is some random chance that one will happen. Let's say that likelihood was 5%. Now, a magnitude 4.7 earthquake happens in your window. It seems like you were pretty close, right? You should be able to count that as a success, shouldn't you? But the random chance of a 4.7 in such a scenario would be not 5%, but 10%, twice the likelihood. And you've allowed your definition of what constitutes a successful prediction to be defined by what actually happened, undermining the value of the statistics. Compound this with a little flexibility as to the location and the timing, and even well-intentioned predictions begin to lack meaning. Many a researcher has fallen down this rabbit hole until stopped by a statistician. Most seismologists now insist that even an apparently successful prediction could be specious. A method needs to show predictive validity over multiple events and be demonstrably better than random chance. We have fallen victim over the decades to too many false alarms to demand less. Otherwise, our confirmation bias will fool us into thinking we've discovered a pattern, when in fact, all we've done is create constellations out of randomly arranged stars. In January 2009, a swarm of earthquakes began near the ancient Italian city of L'Aquila. L'Aquila was built in the Middle Ages by Frederick II, the Holy Roman Emperor, as a walled city to protect a federation of 99 villages. He was defending them and his own realm against the growing political power of the papacy. Thus its name, which means the eagle. It has been the transportation, commercial, and communication center of the area for centuries, and it stands now as the capital of the Abruzzo region of Italy. It sits high in the Apennines, at 2,800 feet of elevation, and more than 70,000 people call it home. It has a long history of earthquakes. Deadly ones have been recorded from 1349, 800 victims, 1703, 3,000 victims, and 1786, 6,000 victims. The swarm that began in January continued through February and March 2009, with numerous felt earthquakes. In light of the city's seismic history, its residents' nerves started to fray. Schools were evacuated several times in the first few months of 2009. Enter Giampaolo Giuliani, a resident of L'Aquila and a technician at the National Laboratory of Gran Sasso, part of the National Nuclear Physics Institute. Giuliani worked on machines designed to detect radioactive gases. And by early 2009, he had been examining earthquake patterns and their relationship to the presence of radon for nearly a decade. The new swarm offered an opportunity to put his ideas to the test. In February 2009, he put forth a set of predictions based on his radon measurements, which were given to the media and inspired a variety of stories. He never submitted a written prediction to authorities, so we don't know exactly what he was predicting. We have only the media reports. In response to these predictions, scientists at the government's Earthquake Research Center, the INGV, made public statements consistent with the current understanding of earthquakes in the region. That these types of swarms were common, reliable earthquake prediction was still impossible, and the risk of big earthquakes was still low. Although these are true statements, they did little to assuage public anxiety. In mid-March, as the earthquakes continued unabated, an Italian blog, Done Democratiche, asked for Giuliani's opinion about the ongoing earthquake activity. He said that the swarm was a normal phenomenon for the region, not a precursor to a larger event, and would be diminished by the end of March. But on March 30th, the largest event up to that point, a magnitude 4.1, struck L'Aquila. Giuliani offered another prediction in response. He told the mayor of the town of Sulmona, 35 miles southeast of L'Aquila, to expect a damaging earthquake within 6 to 24 hours. The mayor responded, "Vans mounted with loudspeakers drove through the town, broadcasting warnings and urging residents to flee. Many abandoned their homes, but ultimately no earthquake struck." So Giuliani had at least twice made definitive predictions that failed to bear out. Meanwhile, earthquakes were being felt regularly, and the media was still turning to him for comment. The Italian government struggled to contain him. Authorities told Giuliani he was needlessly panicking residents. But despite his previous failures, more than a few residents believed his predictions. The government needed to craft a message as convincing as Giuliani's. It fell to the Italian National Commission for the Forecast and Prevention of Major Risks, the formal government mechanism for communication between the National Civil Protection Service, what in the United States is often called emergency services, and the scientific community. The committee, composed of earthquake scientists and engineers, meets once a year in Rome to review research and monitoring activities, but could also be called on an emergency basis to evaluate an imminent risk. In an unusual move, the government convened a special meeting of the Major Risks Commission in L'Aquila on Saturday, March 30th, that lasted just 1 hour. The only minutes of that meeting were compiled 1 month later, so they offer a not particularly reliable source. We know that authorities went into the meeting to create a reassuring narrative. The head of civil protection, Guido Bertolazzo, was recorded saying as much in a pre-meeting wiretap, which had been initiated as part of a different investigation. In particular, he said that the experts were going to tell the public, "It's better that there are 100 magnitude 4 tremors rather than silence, because 100 tremors release energy, and there won't ever be the damaging tremor." After the meeting concluded, the six scientists in attendance left immediately, while the vice director of civil protection, Bernardo De Bernardinis, gave a press conference about the meeting. He echoed his boss's earlier wiretapped assertion about the benefits of swarms. "The scientific community tells us there is no danger," he said, "because there is an ongoing discharge of energy. The situation looks favorable." In reply to a reporter's question, he agreed that yes, people should calm down with a glass of wine. The argument that formed the basis of De Bernardini's and Bertolaso's reassurances that small earthquakes reduced the risk of big earthquakes is patently false. It is a bit of folk wisdom, one that I am asked about frequently, and that arises from nothing so much as wishful thinking. Big earthquakes release more energy than small ones. If we have a lot of small ones, the argument goes, shouldn't that release the pent-up energy? While it makes intuitive sense, it contradicts the most consistent feature of earthquakes we've observed, one that Charlie Richter saw in the first set of earthquakes for which he calculated magnitudes, that we see in every aftershock sequence, and that occurs in any regional grouping of earthquakes around the world. The relative number of small to large earthquakes is constant. More small earthquakes means more big ones. Mathematicians call this a self-similar distribution. With the Richter scale, this means that if there is one magnitude 3, we can expect approximately 10 magnitude 2s. If there is one magnitude 6, there will be approximately 10 magnitude 5s, 100 magnitude 4s, and 1,000 magnitude 3s. We may see small variations, of course, but this distribution is a truism in seismology. No seismologist would ever suggest that having many small earthquakes would make a bigger earthquake less likely. So why did the Civil Protection Authority say that it did? We know from Bertolaso's taped conversation that he had this message in mind prior to the meeting. The Civil Protection Authorities are the ones charged with the public protection. No scientists were at the press conference. It appears they were not invited. One said he didn't know it had happened until he returned to Rome. But why didn't the seismologists speak up afterward and say their spokesman was wrong? The next week, late at night on April 5th, Palm Sunday, a magnitude 3.9 struck the city. Dr. Vincenzo Vittorini, a 48-year-old surgeon and native of L'Aquila, later spoke to Nature magazine about his reaction. "My father was afraid of earthquakes," he recalled. "So whenever the ground shook, even a little, he would gather us and take us out of the house. We would walk to a little piazza nearby, and the children, we were four brothers, and my mother would sleep in the car. When the magnitude 4.1 had hit L'Aquila a week earlier, his terrified wife had called him, and he had followed his father's lead, telling her to go outside and stay there for a while. But this time, he remembered the press conference, in which authorities had declared that a big one was less likely, an idea the town had been discussing in the intervening week. He, his wife, and their daughter debated what to do, and he eventually persuaded them to stay inside. The three were together in the master bed several hours later at 3:32 a.m. on April 6th when the big one hit, a magnitude 6.3 earthquake that tore L'Aquila asunder. While such a magnitude may seem small next to the earthquakes of the Pacific Rim, shaking directly atop a fault with an earthquake this size can be extreme. Essentially every building sustained damage. 20,000 were destroyed altogether. The historic center, which had been rebuilt after the 1703 earthquake, was mostly destroyed. It has remained off limits in the years since, deemed too dangerous to enter. Even more modern buildings, those erected in the boom after World War II, were mostly designed before the institution of seismic codes, and many suffered from substandard materials and construction. Dormitories at the University of L'Aquila collapsed, killing students. More than 60,000 people were made homeless by the earthquake. The government set up refugee centers with tents that housed 40,000 of them. The Italian Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, did little to soothe sensibilities when he suggested that citizens should be grateful that the government was financing their stay, that they should treat it like a holiday at the beach. Dr. Vittorini described the earthquake as like being in a giant blender. His apartment building, constructed in 1962, collapsed altogether. His third-floor apartment came to rest just a few feet above the ground. He was pulled out alive 6 hours later. His wife and 9-year-old daughter died, two of the 309 victims of the destruction of their city. As we have seen, every disaster provokes an impulse to blame. The suffering citizens of L'Aquila had an easy target in the government authorities and their unwarranted assurances. The government responded by convening an International Commission on Earthquake Forecasting for Civil Protection just a few weeks after the disaster. They brought in 10 leaders in seismology from 9 countries, representing China, France, Italy, the United Kingdom, Germany, Greece, Russia, Japan, and the United States. The commission was chaired by Dr. Thomas Jordan, the former chair of earth sciences at MIT, then director of the Southern California Earthquake Center. He and his team performed a comprehensive review of earthquake prediction around the world, confirming that such prediction was impossible. Their conclusion, issued several months after the earthquake, was that the scientific community needed to take ownership not just of their research, but of communicating effectively to the public. While this went away toward assigning responsibility for the destruction of L'Aquila, it proved insufficient. 17 months after the earthquake, the scientists and civil protection officials were blamed in a much more concrete way. In September 2011, the prosecutor for the state of Abruzzo issued an indictment charging Bernardo De Bernardinis, the vice director of civil protection, and the 6 seismologists and engineers who had participated in the fateful meeting on March 30th with involuntary manslaughter for their role in issuing false assurances to the public. International science organizations responded with outrage. The American Association for the Advancement of Science, the International Union of Geology and Geophysics, and the Seismological Society of America, among others, sent letters to Italy condemning the indictments as an attack on science. But L'Aquila never represented a failure of science. It was a failure to communicate the nuances of the data. In the face of tragedy, we always ask, what could have been done differently? In L'Aquila, there was a very obvious answer. Distracted by Giuliani's predictions, the authorities did not emphasize this increase in hazard, Dr. Jordan of the International Commission observed. Neither did they focus on advising the people of L'Aquila about preparatory measures warranted by the seismic crisis. Instead, they were snookered into addressing a simple yes or no question. Will we be hit by a larger earthquake? By saying no, they presented a much more definitive and, in the end, incorrect statement. The prosecution's case rested on the personal testimony of people like Dr. Vittorini. Another victim, Maurizio Cora, spoke of taking his family to an open plaza after the March 30th magnitude 4.1 event, but because of the government's assurances, staying home after the magnitude 3.9 event on the night of April 5th. His wife and both daughters perished in the collapse of his apartment building. Their testimony was compelling, and the prosecution prevailed. All seven defendants were convicted and sentenced to 6 years in jail. Over the next 3 years, the convictions went through two appeals courts. The original judge had concluded that the experts had carried out a superficial, approximate, and generic risk analysis, and thus had failed to do their duties on the risk commission. An appeals court overturned this ruling based on the content of the commission members' analysis. It was a valid scientific opinion, even if not consensus across the field, to suggest, as their findings did, that there was no reason to believe the risk had changed significantly as a result of the earthquakes. In the appeal that followed, the prosecutor argued that the crime was in the scientists' failure to reject the favorable discharge of energy idea that Vice Director DeBernardinis offered up at his press conference. In the end, the court ruled that only DeBernardinis was at fault. His conviction was confirmed with a reduced sentence of 2 years, while the scientists were acquitted. While such a legal proceeding is highly unusual, the Italian scientists' predicament is not. My colleagues and I faced a similar one in California. 3 weeks before the L'Aquila earthquake, a magnitude 4.8 earthquake happened just 3 miles from the southern end of the San Andreas Fault. The location is meaningful because earthquakes are more likely to trigger other earthquakes in nearby areas. If, as in this case, a very long fault is very nearby, this greatly increases the chance of triggering a very big earthquake. Almost 2 decades earlier, I had worked with a colleague from UC San Diego, Duncan Agnew, to create a methodology for estimating this increased hazard. We projected that a triggering earthquake such as the one we experienced in March 2009 would result in a 1 to 5% chance of a big, at least magnitude 7, earthquake on the San Andreas Fault occurring within the next 3 days. The California equivalent of the Italian Risk Commission was the California Earthquake Prediction Evaluation Council, or CPEC. I was serving on CPEC at the time, and within an hour of the magnitude 4.8, we had convened a conference call. It took a couple of hours to come to agreement, so it was a few hours after the earthquake that our one-page statement of concern was given to the state of California. In it, we pointed out that the risk was low in absolute terms, but still hundreds of times higher than the long-term risk. We prepared a suggested public release with specific actions that could be taken by Southern California residents, such as checking their water supplies. All that was left was for the state to release our statement. This process was the result of an agreement between the scientists of California and the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, CalOES, that dated back to the late 1980s. Because CalOES has to deal with the consequences of these statements, they understandably want to see them first and be their conduit to the public. So a protocol was worked out between the seismic networks, CPEC, and CalOES, wherein the networks processed the data to determine what was going on, CPEC crafted an assessment of the risk, and CalOES released it to the press and the public. To keep scientists from going out on their own, CalOES committed to sharing such information within 30 minutes of its transmittal. This agreement was hammered out at a time when a lot of earthquakes were happening in California, from 1986 to 1994. We had plenty of opportunities then to see what worked and what didn't. But by 2009, we had entered a relatively quiet time, with few significant earthquakes. Governors had been voted in and out of office. Officials, scientists, and technicians retired. Relationships were lost. When we at CPEC sent our statement to the governor's office that March, it went to a group of people who were, by and large, coming at such a report for the first time. Nothing happened. No public statement was made. After a few hours, the scientists at the networks and CPEC began to get antsy. A few more hours passed before word finally came back. Cal OES had decided not to make a public statement. We argued about what to do. The risk of a subsequent earthquake dies off rapidly with time, just like aftershocks. So by the time we knew that Cal OES was withholding our statement, at least half of the added risk was gone. The U.S. Geological Survey, as a federal agency, could have made its own public statement, but we didn't have a mechanism in place to approve it. We had always gone through Cal OES. And so, in the end, no public statement was issued, and, as we all know, no earthquake along the San Andreas Fault was triggered. When, just weeks later, L'Aquila hit and scientists were held accountable, Thomas Jordan, who was involved in both as chairman of the International Commission on Earthquake Forecasting and as a member of CPEC, and I realized that we had dodged a bullet. If a San Andreas earthquake had been triggered, and if it became known, as it surely would have, that scientists had said there was a 5% chance of it occurring, because our 1 to 5% range would undoubtedly have been truncated, and that we had not informed the public, we would have been eviscerated, and we would have deserved it. Science works only when its practitioners are free to argue opposing sides. Many of the Italian scientists caught up in the L'Aquila prosecutions will likely never again offer an opinion on the geologic hazard of a situation, and you can understand their hesitation. But deciding to withhold such information for fear that it might be misunderstood, or worse, could be manipulated by the public, does the public a disservice. Disasters leave in their wake a void of information. If scientists don't fill it, someone else will. L'Aquila amply demonstrates the danger that such a situation presents. Scientists labor in an unusual setting, one that assumes conflict and debate, where a certain amount of training and expertise is assumed. When we find that those outside our field fail to appreciate what we are trying to say, it is way too easy for us to assign them the blame and not our failure to effectively communicate. Scientific research largely takes place in universities and government laboratories. These settings reward breakthroughs, placing the best papers in the most distinguished journals. Time spent translating science for public consumption is time spent away from the work that's most likely to advance one's career. Meanwhile, there are the local governments, urban planners, engineers, and utility managers on the other end of the spectrum, charged with acting on the latest science to build safer cities, manage ecosystems, and protect our lifelines and transportation systems. They aren't funded to translate our research into application. The scientific endeavor has created too large a gap between the scientists and the people their work can best serve. At the most fundamental level, we still need seismologists to research how earthquakes operate. Even today, we don't know what makes one earthquake slip a few yards along a fault and stop, becoming a magnitude 1, and another slip for 100 miles to a magnitude 7. We don't know if it's a product of something in the earth before an earthquake begins, or if it happens dynamically, dependent on what the earthquake runs into or doesn't as it moves down a fault. If it's the latter, we'll likely never be able to offer the kind of prediction people crave. For now, we have the one non-random piece of the earthquake puzzle, what we know about foreshocks, aftershocks, and triggering. We need to share such information with the public as clearly as we can. We need to trust the public with this information. The fear of misunderstanding leaves in the dark too many people who could use our insights to help themselves. Science can function only when its results are shared. For now, I can say that there will be an earthquake in California today and every day. How big it is will be anyone's guess. Chapter 11, The Island of Ill Fortune, Tohoku, Japan, 2011. If paradise now arises in hell, it's because in the suspension of the usual order and the failure of most systems, we are free to live and act another way. Rebecca Solnit, A Paradise Built in Hell. Great catastrophes are never caused by one factor alone. We can cope with and respond to an isolated event. You might think of it like the elements involved in a car accident. If one driver hadn't been distracted by his children, and if another hadn't changed lanes at that precise moment, and if a third car hadn't lost traction due to the rain, there might be no incident to speak of. Remove any one of the elements, and the moment can be withstood, corrected for. We've seen the principle play out in societies facing natural disasters. The earthquakes in Lisbon and Tokyo became catastrophes not just due to their massive shaking, but because of the fires they triggered, compounded by an unfortunate time of day or day of the year. What if the Lisbon earthquake hadn't struck during church services for All Saints' Day? If Tokyo hadn't hit at lunch hour? New Orleans wasn't destroyed by Hurricane Katrina singly, but by the subsequent failure of man-made levees. What if those levees had been inspected by the U.S. Army rather than by a local commission? It's a familiar refrain now that natural disasters expose and apply pressure to weak points. They can result in profound systemic change. A forest in a climate that is getting hotter and drier can survive the stress for a while, until a wildfire burns it down so thoroughly that it simply cannot grow back. That ecosystem is gone, to be replaced by plants and animals better adapted to the new climate. The same holds for social systems, as these same disasters have demonstrated. But alongside the devastation that an extreme natural event can bring, there are also opportunities. Disasters have contributed to the collapse of civilizations, but they've also been the catalyst for needed social change. The Great East Japan Earthquake of March 11, 2011 was just such an event, both an accumulation of physical and man-made forces that together led to catastrophe, and one that offered an opportunity, whose impact was so severe that long-standing tenets of the culture were, and still are, being reshaped. The women described in this chapter are emblematic of these changes. They contributed to their communities in ways they never could have imagined before disaster struck. The 2011 earthquake blew apart many of the constraints of their traditional culture and created opportunities for them and others like them to lead. Because Japan is, at its core, a chain of volcanoes, flat space is a prized resource, forming only where rivers have, over millions of years, smoothed out ridges and valleys. On the main Japanese island of Honshu, a long valley runs north of Tokyo, creating a conduit for trade and a chain of cities that were historically the strongholds of various samurai clans. The city of Fukushima lies along this valley, 200 miles north of Tokyo, close to the heart of Japan. Its name is translated as Island of Good Fortune, and indeed it was. Until March 11, 2011, Fukushima was a thriving, prosperous community. On that day, Maki Sahara was in her home in Fukushima City. Slender and tall, with long bangs and shoulder-length hair, this young housewife was looking forward to her daughter's graduation from preschool the next day. In Japan, the school year ends in March, and preschools have a formal graduation to mark the children's entrance to a new stage of life. 2 days earlier, a magnitude 7.2 earthquake had rattled the home. But an earthquake of that size strikes once or twice a year somewhere in Japan, and so, accustomed to the disruption, Maki didn't pay it too much mind. Maki was going to be the representative of the Parents and Teachers Association at the ceremony, and she recalls laying out the kimono she would wear. A traditional kimono is a complicated ensemble, and she needed to get all the pieces in order. Maki remembers thinking not only of her 6-year-old daughter at preschool, but also of her husband, who was at work at a nearby hotel. Her two nieces, staying at their grandparents, were also on her mind. Their mother was in the hospital, battling leukemia, and Maki helped look after them while their mother was in treatment. At 2:46 p.m., as the kimono lay on Maki's bed, the shaking began. A massive earthquake threw her to the floor. She braced herself, waiting for the shaking to stop. And waiting. Shaking so strong it was impossible to stand persisted for over a minute. The earthquake was magnitude 9 and had occurred just offshore. The fault was about 250 miles long, centered due east of Fukushima. The earthquake was the fourth largest ever recorded and had the largest slip ever seen. Until then, the world's largest slip had been the 1960 Chilean earthquake. That fault was 800 miles long, and it showed a maximum slip of about 120 feet. That means two objects that were adjacent on opposite sides of the fault would, in an instant, have been more than 100 feet apart. Compare this to the mere 26 feet of buildup along the San Andreas Fault today. The Japanese earthquake, though on a fault only one-third the length of the 1960 Chilean earthquake, still saw a maximum slip of 240 feet, twice the largest ever seen before. It was an earthquake most seismologists would have said couldn't happen, until it did. It is a testament to the building codes that Japan had developed, and just as important, rigorously enforced, that this earthquake, which would have leveled buildings in many other countries, created only a mess of broken dishes for Maki. Although her house was fine, the electricity was out, and cell phone systems were too overloaded to use. First, she ran to the preschool and brought her daughter home. Her husband came soon after, making sure his family was safe before returning to the hotel to take care of terrified guests. Maki and her daughter settled down, waiting for life to return to normal. But for Maki, life, as a mother, as a homemaker, would never be quite the same. North of Fukushima, farther along the valley, lies the city of Sendai. While Maki was preparing for her daughter's preschool graduation, a 35-year-old Canadian researcher in political science, Jackie Steele, was participating in another Japanese tradition to mark the 6-month birthday of her infant daughter, Senna. She and her partner had brought Senna to a photography studio in a big shopping mall for a series of portraits in kimono, dress clothes, and even a bumblebee costume. They had just gotten Senna back into her own clothes and were starting to pick out which pictures they wanted to keep when the trembling began. They crouched on the floor, and as the shaking continued and grew in intensity, the mall's power went out, and darkness enveloped them. Jackie held her baby under her through the interminable moment, marveling at the calm of the employees around her. When the shaking finally stopped, the emergency lights produced a dull red glimmer, and store employees led the customers in the oft-drilled evacuation plan to the roof of the building. The roof was a parking area, and Jackie's car was nearby, but she didn't leave. Once again, the building sustained no significant damage, but now the people around her were in shock. Jackie recalls a man attempting to drive away, who couldn't seem to remember what to do. He alternately raced the accelerator and slammed the brakes. His car seemed to stand up on its front. She didn't want to be on the road with people in this state, so she decided to wait it out on the roof, wrapped in blankets supplied by the employees of the mall. 200 miles to the south, at the other end of the Long Valley, sits Tokyo, where 38 million people fill the area that surrounds the Tokyo Bay. Megumi Ishimoto, a slight, energetic 40-year-old, worked in one of the city's many high-rises as an executive assistant to the CEO of a financial services company. Dissatisfied with her career, eager to do more than make money for investors, she was considering going abroad to engage in humanitarian work. When the earthquake began to shake her high-rise, she wasn't thrown to the floor. Whereas Fukushima and Sendai both lay due west of the earthquake fault, close to the source of the waves, Tokyo lay south of the southern end of the earthquake rupture zone. The earthquake's waves had to travel farther to reach the city, which meant that while the shaking was very strong and lasted for almost 2 minutes, the sharpest jolts, the fastest high-frequency shaking, had been dampened along the way. On the 38th floor of a Tokyo high-rise, those slow waves felt to Megumi like she was in a large cruise ship being tossed about on rough seas. In the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, power was lost, and the city's vaunted train and subway systems were shut down. Millions and millions of commuters had to get home on foot. Megumi was lucky that she lived relatively nearby, and it took her only 2 hours to walk home. Many of her co-workers walked for 6 or 8 hours to get home and find out if their families were okay. All things considered, however, Tokyo did not suffer much damage. At this point, Japan seemed to have withstood an impossibly large earthquake. Had this been the extent of it, it would have been a nation bruised but still sound. The driver momentarily distracted by his children, but who manages to avoid a collision. The forest diminished by a drought, but that ultimately continues to thrive. The catastrophe that followed was the result of more than just this one event, and it had unforeseeable consequences. It was 6 years earlier that the Sumatran earthquake had struck. As was revealed to horrified onlookers, an offshore earthquake's greatest damage is often inflicted not by the shaking, but by the resulting shift in the seafloor. The East Japan earthquake moved a 250-mile-long block of rock as much as 240 feet, displacing a great deal of water and leading inevitably to a tsunami. Waves struck the northeasternmost part of Honshu, called Tohoku. The Tohoku region is a rugged coastline, punctuated by small towns, most of which are fishing towns, that harvest the seafood the Japanese cuisine is known for. Rural and isolated, this area is one of the more traditional parts of Japan. Eldest sons inherit farms, remaining in the family home with their parents. Wives live with their in-laws, and young mothers are expected to keep small children out of public view, creating a very limited life for women. Tsunamis, like earthquakes, are part of life in Japan, and most towns had established defenses. In March 2011, at the time of this event, many had built seawalls up to 20 feet high to protect the flatland around the harbors where these towns had sprung up. The tsunami would take 15 to 30 minutes to reach the shore, and residents had been trained to go to high ground after such a strong earthquake. They were aware of the danger and thought they were ready. And they were ready for the tsunami that seismologists expected. But this earthquake exceeded all predictions for what the offshore fault could produce. The actual tsunami was several times larger than expected, at many places over 45 feet high. One location saw waves 100 feet high. It simply overwhelmed them. Alongside the northern half of the rupture, where the largest slip on the fault occurred, wave heights were all above 30 feet. Tide gauges in that section were destroyed by extreme waves. We can't know how large they were, only that they were larger than the height at which the instruments broke. In the Tohoku town of Otsuchi, Takuya Ueno lived with his parents in the home his family held for generations. A 33-year-old salaryman, Takuya was one of the few people in town with a university degree. Otsuchi was a small community of 16,000 people, many working as fishermen or in fish processing plants. As part of the management team for a manufacturing center, Takuya commuted each day to the largest city in the region, 40 miles to the north. As soon as the shaking stopped, he and his co-workers headed uphill. They watched the tsunami sweep through the city below, surge after surge, washing upon it for hours. He and his colleagues survived, but they were stranded. The roads Takuya needed to drive home were destroyed. He had no way of getting there. He worked his way to an uncle's nearby house and waited. Takuya's mother, Hiro, had spent the day at a medical clinic back in Otsuchi, helping her diabetic brother get care. She didn't drive, so her husband had dropped them off at the hospital. After the earthquake, knowing the tsunami risk, the patients and staff were all taken to the roof of the building, a practice called vertical evacuation. It would have been impossible to get that many elderly and infirm people to safety in any other way. The building was just tall enough to exceed the waves, and the patients survived, watching first the waves and then the fires destroy their homes. Others in Otsuchi weren't so lucky. The city council met in an emergency session at City Hall immediately after the earthquake. Their protocol had required them to leave City Hall and move to high ground, but they decided to stay in place. The magnitude 7.2 earthquake 2 days earlier had resulted in a tsunami warning, but nothing had happened. The warning for this earthquake